This is Tractor Tuesday Live, hosted by sixth generation Nebraska farmer and Tractor Tuesday founder Zach Bosley and Scott Anderson, owner of New Age Ag Supply. Join them each week as they sit down with farmers, innovators, dealers, and creators who are enhancing the culture within agriculture, right here on Tractor Tuesday Live.
Hey, everybody, it is Tuesday, and we are live right here today. With us, as usual, is Scott Anderson, New Age Ag Supply. And then today, we've got an awesome guest here in the house as well. We've got Kevin Anderson. And I think, Scott, you might know this guy a little bit better than I do. But, Kevin, thanks again for joining us. And if you don't mind, give the whole world here online a brief introduction.
Okay. Yes. Kevin Anderson, Scott's dad and Corey's dad, two boys. And I wanted to start out by thanking my two boys for putting up with all my wild, crazy ideas over the years, because I had plenty of them, and that's the way an inventor is, kind of, you know?
Yeah, well,
and no regrets. Agriculture is one fantastic business with fantastic people that I work with all over the world.
No, that's great. And it must not have been too stressful as an inventor. You got a great head of hair on you, and I guess I see where Scott and the boys get it from. So,
Well, I'm very bashful. So you'll really have to pry the question up, you know.
Yeah. Well, now we know a little bit about your background, and when I first met Scott, I had no idea that this was the same household, you know. And for better or worse, there's so many Andersons that I deal with, and even in my area, there's, I don't know if they're all the same family, but there's some phenomenal farmers, big landowners with the same last name, and a few of the times there's actually one of them by the name of Scott as a customer. And was calling me, and I thought, oh, this is Scotty. And well, no, it was your son, because the 402 number always threw me off, Scott. But in that Andover area in South Dakota. So it kind of confused me a little bit. But, you know, to kind of get into all of this, I think initially it was Anderson Machine Incorporated. And I know there's been some different iterations, different entities that you've expanded upon, but how did you get into, I guess, even the mind frame to be this great and prolific inventor? And I guess, what was the first breakthrough moment or product that you invented that you put to market?
Oh, well, I did kind of want to start by talking about a little of the background of our family.
You
can imagine this, it's pretty cool. Not many people can say they have this, and Scott knows the whole story too. But if you can imagine, my grandfather Anderson graduated from what was a pre-University of Minnesota with a ag business degree in 13.
Oh, wow.
You know, and only reason I know that, you know, my grandmother's put all the history of our families into these big old trunks and stuck them in the basement, and about half the stuff rotted away, but some of it was still there. And okay. One of his U of M books called American Business Standards. If you can remember that book, you can still get it. I actually got it online and gave both Corey and Scott that book for Christmas one year. And it is common sense on making a business work, you know, working with the personalities you have to work with. And the other book is called Facts and Figures for Artisans in Every Trade. And that was a bunch of volume books that were in these trunks, and a lot of them spoiled, and the authors were Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse of that book.
Oh, wow.
AC and DC Power.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, so that's... precious books like that were written in common words, common sense, and you could just be like a big sponge and you never hardly forget a thing about it. So that's how some of the stuff that I attribute, you know, some of the successes, at least steering me in the right direction. And do you want me to talk starting to invent the opener and stuff?
Yeah, that'd be great. But I think it's awesome. You mentioned those two books. I was familiar with as the train is honking at me, with the American Standards and the business book. I honestly never read it, Yeah, my uncle bought it for me once for Christmas, and I think I just left it on the shelf.
Really?
I was probably too young to appreciate what he gifted me.
Yeah, what year did you get? They redid it every so many years.
I know I have it, and I need to go back through the dusty shelf here and see what issue or edition it was. Yeah, I think it was an older version because it didn't look like it had a modern cover on it.
About every 2 years, they reprinted a new one.
Yeah, it's probably about 1998, I'm assuming. But I don't necessarily know this for sure.
Really?
Yeah. So I know I've got the copy somewhere because I've got a trunk of, you know, all these old books, and sadly I didn't ever actually read it. So, but it's cool. I think it'd be kind of fun to come up with some of these business books and, you know, put this list out there because that's a great question to start asking other guests, you know, what shaped, you know, some of this thought and logic. And, I think a lot of times, most folks like yourself would probably reference a book or two. So that's a great point. But Scott, sorry, go ahead.
One unique thing about Dad, and I think this is kind of a foundational thing to Dad's success, and he can talk more about this. I'll just bring it up. But Dad was a musician for maybe you want to talk about how you got into musician work, which kind of created a lot of, you know, musicians are extremely creative. They have to think outside the box to come up with not only ways to entertain people, but new music and all this other stuff. And Dad's an unbelievably good singer, and he played guitar as well. He still sings at weddings and funerals and events like that. But Dad, how'd you get into music, and how do you see that connecting to your success? Because you're definitely an unbelievable performer, even when just giving us a little presentation or talking, because Dad spoke on stages all over the world.
Well, that's interesting. That would come up. But when I graduated from high school, I was in all-state chorus and singing. And then I auditioned for a chance to go to Europe and sing with a huge choir and symphony called American Youth in Concert. And I auditioned, and I got to go to Europe for a month. And we landed in Rome. We practiced at a college with over 600 people in the choir and the orchestra. And you know, we were just out of high school in 1973, and just bulletproof, as you could imagine. You know, and we really had fun. We played on all the wonderful places in the world, worked our way all the way to England. Then we flew back to New York and had our finale in Carnegie Hall. Oh, and wow. The one thing that sticks out was that was amazing. Every concert we did, the final song was the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And, you know, mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. That song didn't matter what, if they couldn't understand English, they knew that song, and there wasn't a dry eye in the whole place. It was just time after time after time for a whole month solid. It was one precious event with wonderful people.
Have you ever found yourself as a singer, you know, singing something that inspiring or emotional and just kind of losing control of your own emotion, or can you? Are you been able to kind of breathe through it and hold it together?
Oh, that's the fun part, getting emotional singing, you know.
Okay.
You know, that's always fun. And so then you know, doing rock and roll and farming were a lot the same, because if we ever made any money, we bought more equipment.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, and ever.
And that's the truth.
Oh, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen it.
You'd be playing a gig, and some guy had too much to drink, and he put his foot through the speaker. Well, then now you had to fix the speaker, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
there you but go. It was, I wouldn't change a thing. It was wonderful. The people were wonderful and great. The musicians, you know?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I had no idea about that. Now that was a cool point to bring up, and it does really spawn some creativity and just to think through and, you know, different chord structures and progressions and just how it all ties in together. And I think it makes sense, I guess, even if you look at the visual of written music and, you know, just how it all comes into becoming something, you know, and there's so many different pieces.
I used to have to know 40 songs by heart for every night.
Yeah. Yeah. That's you know, quite something.
Which is, yeah,
a little taxing, but it's, you know, it's interesting. Some people just have those minds, and you know, my son's about 3.5, and God, he's got the 12 days of Christmas almost down pat. And it's just, some people are just open to taking in lyrics and then being able to articulate them again off of memory. It's really a, yeah, it's a gift. It's a talent, you know, and it's just, it's, so would you consider yourself more of a visual learner, or how does your mind necessarily work being that musically inclined?
Oh boy. Yeah. You had to be able to memorize. Mm-hmm. And to have that many songs memorized, you know, and then they constantly changed. Like, we had to play the music that the people hired us to play. Mm-hmm. If you were in a country western, you know, situation, you better know a lot of country songs. And yeah. If you were in a high school prom, you better know the newest, latest, greatest top 40 stuff. You know, yeah. So yeah, it was always challenging, but that was the fun part about it. The only way we made good money was playing in a nightclub for like a solid week, so we didn't have to drive around and move all the time. You know, that was our biggest, you know, but it was always a problem with people that had too much to drink, you know, wanting to get up on the stage and do something wild, you know.
Oh yeah, I can imagine. So. Yeah, no, that's an awesome introduction here to everything that you've been a part of, Kevin, because we just know of you for your innovations and your inventions primarily in ag. And that's, again, I was shocked that, you know, as I've gotten to know Scott over the past year or so, that, you know, this is you, and it's a pretty cool story here. So I guess from, you know, graduating high school and being a part of this orchestra and touring, did you end up going to college yourself then after, I assume you graduated in 73?
I was too busy for college.
Okay. Or you might have been right on time and smart. You know, my dad graduated high school in 73 as well. So there's a little bit of a...
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he's probably watching right now. Yeah, it was a good year, they said. He was a little bit young, you know, to graduate. I think he turned 17 during his senior year, so... I think either my grandparents wanted him out of the house, or that just made sense. So, yeah. But then did you just jump right into agriculture then when you got back from the European tour? Or?
Well, I started working for a company that manufactured fertilizer, and they were real, you know, gung-ho people, and they still are in business. And I got into the soil sampling division. And I started designing soil samplers that we could have and put in the middle of a pickup and drive around all over these different places and you know, soil sample. And then I designed an area, because we had to dry all the soil samples, and then we had to grind them and mix them and then send them to the lab for you know, analysis and stuff. And it gave us a real basis of, you know, why is this stuff so good, or why did it turn bad in the soil part? And you know, that whenever you guys are ready, that leads me into the openers and the designs that I did that just huge differences in agriculture.
Yeah. So how many years did you work with them until you got more full time again with the farm operation?
Probably about 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. 10 years. And then my dad needed help on the farm. And so I got into the farming with him, and farming, basically the farmers were still, you know, the initial settlers that took an ox and turned the soil over, basically, they were living on mineralizing the carbon in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any soil scientists that are listening would know that, you know, soil is mostly carbon. And, you know, as soon as they mineralized all the carbon, why, then they'd have to move. So that's why they were moving west. They were moving west because they couldn't make a living on the land that they mineralized all the carbon in, you know?
Yeah.
So
you're kind of getting into the early 80s then. You're getting more hands-on with farming, you know, potentially at one of the worst times, at least, you know, in my lifetime, I guess you could say. And it's just, things are a little bit different up in, you know, your part of South Dakota. I guess in the early 80s, what were the primary crops being raised in your area specifically?
Well, at that time, we were raising pretty much all small grains, you know, and we would drive to Minnesota and say, how come their fields are all green with corn and ours is all ready to harvest in June? Fried, it's burned up, you know, and we learned that long season crops would work for us if we knew what we knew how to do it, you know, and stuff. And but otherwise, we harvested everything, you know, by August, everything was done. And then my dad would say, well, I got to get out there and work all that soil black, you know, so that way it'll be just like summer fallow, you know.
And then things really started to change, it sounds like.
It was the wrong thing to do, you know, and and so we've, you know, and I started to, I actually built a machine in my factory, my shop. It was called a soil bin, and this soil bin was 30 feet long with soil troughs in it that were about 5 feet wide, and I built an arm that a computer would run back and forth at different ground speeds so I could see what different ground engaging equipment would do.
Oh,
you know, and my wife always told me, you go to the shop in the wintertime, you're still playing in the dirt. And then the neighbors would all come over, and the guys with new ideas would come over, and they go, Kevin, you got to try this thing for me. So I would actually sign a document that would say, okay, this is your new invention. I have my own inventions, and I will guarantee you that I will not copy your invention, because they could run it in my soil bin and see exactly what it was doing at whatever ground speed they wanted to see it at, you know, and that was pretty huge. You know, and I could change the soil type by changing the pans out. If they said, well, my soil is heavy, so I don't know how it's going to work in your soil, I'd say, well, you just bring me a pickup load of soil. We'll dump it in the empty pans and we'll run it in there, you know.
Oh, wow.
So it was really fun. I had wonderful people that were, you know, creative minds that said, well, I think I got an idea here. And I said, I will protect your idea because here's the documentation that I won't copy it and stuff. So.
Yeah, that was pretty generous of you, really. When you're kind of hosting the collaboration there, I guess a lot of guys might have been a little bit insecure about some of that because you were the inventor. And,
it's
nice getting that feedback, but at a certain point, you know, the house, you know, you got to pay for the lights and keep things going. So, I guess it's interesting. Did anything come from those groups that, you know, other farmers that became actual investment or patented?
And Scott knows most of the people. Like, the one of them is we invented a rotary harrow that that would, you know, seal the soil back up after the opener went through it, and that was actually from a company from Australia, and I got to be wonderful friends with this guy, and he came in there with his product. We ran it right in the testing trough back and forth in the middle of the winter, and we actually came out. I helped him develop a module that would could go on any type of planting system and seal the soil up after the opener went through and placed the seed and fertilizer. It was great. And you know, it's easy for everybody to copy that stuff, you know. So once they see it, it's just bang, okay, well, that was my idea too. And but now we were always ahead of the game with that little soil bin. We were ahead of the game all the time, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like it'd be cool to see some, if you had any old pictures from back then, you know, you guys hard at it, and it's just just the visual of that would be a really cool way to maybe add to a little story and, you know, some of your background and some of the other inventions. And I guess, you know, as far as the invention side, your first big breakthrough, I guess if you could start talking about that and, you know, what potentially led up to it, what you were trying to resolve or improve. And then, you know, what is this big product that I think we're all aware of that what I'm alluding to here, if you don't mind, Kevin?
Sure. Well, also the opener part, everybody was making an opener, and I just didn't know where to go with it. You had to have the design parameters on the goals and objectives of the unit, you know? And so the kids' goldfish all died. And so I stole the fish tank And I took the fish tank to the shop, and I filled it full of dirt. And then I put the fertilizer against the glass, and then I put dirt in. And then I put the seed in two rows above that fertilizer against the glass. And then I start and put a grow light there, kept it warm. I wanted to see what was going to happen, you know. Mm-hmm. And as the fertilizer would mineralize and stuff, it would change a little bit. And as the seed was sprouting the first pair of seminal roots and stuff, it was going down. And everybody said, well, you know, because my opener, I said, well, you know, we got to have the fertilizer below the seed. Everybody was spreading the fertilizer on the top of the ground, and the roots don't grow up to get the fertilizer. Mother Nature's got to hit rain and get the fertilizer down to the seed.
Yeah.
You know, and it was all backwards, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, if I can get the fertilizer down there, so no matter what the condition, all the seed has to do is spring out the first pair of seminal roots and go down and just start, and it would just proliferate right around this depot of fertilizer, because everybody else said, no, that it's just going to burn the roots off, and you're going to have a wreck. I said, well, I'm going to find out here. And it wasn't that way at all. Mm. You know, as soon as Mother Nature mineralized the fertilizer so the seed could use it, bang, we're off to the races.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's how it started, you know. Okay. And then so we had to be able to use the all types of different fertilizer. And the biggest challenge fertilizer to use in what I was doing, and if you can visualize this, was NH3, anhydrous ammonia. You know, because it was the cheapest form of nitrogen, and it was actually the best nitrogen. And everybody said, well, you can't put anhydrous ammonia an inch away from the seed. You're going to kill everything. And I said, well, we're going to find out here. And so I got together with one of the endowed chairs of the university in Idaho, because I had a lot of customers out there that were doing the same thing, James Cook. And he and I got to be great friends. And he said, a lot of guys want to use anhydrous ammonia here. And I said, well, how can we detect that ammonia in the soil? And he said, well, we got a pink dye that you can use. And I can't remember the chemical of it, but it was a pink dye that we put down. And then it showed it indicated the position of the anhydrous ammonia. Mm. Yeah, that was because the anhydrous ammonia in the soil itself, you couldn't see it, you know, because it attached to the molecules. But this red dye would go where the ammonia was. And I mean, when we got that, then the research was off to the races and exciting, because everybody said, oh, you're going to kill the seed. And it was just the other way around. The seed used up that ammoniated soil, and there was no loss at all. I mean, if you put on enough fertilizer, spreading it on top for 100 bushel corn, why you could actually use probably close to half doing it the way we were doing it, you know, because there wasn't any denitrification of any type. Denitrification means the nitrogen is going back into the air where it came from, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
so it's amazing. I'm not motivated talking about it either. Nobody's falling asleep, are they?
Oh, I think our audience that we have, they're all, the majority of what we're seeing on our feedback, there's a lot of row crop farmers. And I think we're used to seeing, you know, what you're seeing now through precision planting and, you know, the different applications that you can do. And I think they called it like furrow jet, and you could have three streams of starter and, you know, Schaffert manufacturing here in Indianola, Nebraska.
Oh yeah, Schaffert, yeah.
Yeah, they had kind of a off of their rebounder that have a splitter, you know, to basically split apply your starter. And, you know, so people are aware of, you know, this concept now, thankfully, because of some of the other versions of basically what you created when you created it. And what was the timeline when you started getting this positive feedback, I guess, working with the folks in Idaho there? Are we talking late 80s at this
early
point?
Early 90s.
We're into the 90s.
Early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And interesting. They were wonderful people. And I built them. I actually went back home and I built them a little 8-foot wide research drill to experiment with what we were doing to verify that with this thing is working. And let's see how it works in all kinds of, because there's all kinds of different soils in the hilly Palouse country, you know, and want to make sure. And it was working, you know. So I don't know if Jim Cook is still alive, but it'd be neat to, boy, to get him on the podcast.
Yeah, it'd be fun. I mean, and a lot of people know the name and are familiar, you know, with some of his background too. And it'd be, that's a great one. Yeah, you got to reach out. Is that
right?
I think there's enough people. Oh, in Nebraska, is that right? Yeah. Nebraska is an interesting state because of our ag extension and everything that's going on. And there are so many innovators, you know, really all throughout from North Dakota to Texas and everywhere in between. So there's just a lot of this innovation. You either have a machine shop as a farmer in these areas, or, you know, we run into guys like you that, you know, are really actively inventing. And, you know, a lot of that more so is based on your area. You know, around here is center pivot irrigation. And, you know, some of the folks in northern Kansas have really got into the drip tape. And so there are always ways that they're trying to just make things as farmers more efficient. And you as well. Now, you know, back to this with the opener, was there a main commodity or seed that you were testing on, or were you basically just looking at anything that could use a little bit of nitrogen?
Yeah, we planted every crop possible. You know, that's the only way you could make sure that it worked in all soil types, in all climates, and in all different areas, you know, because the Pacific Northwest is quite a bit different than we are in South Dakota and Nebraska.
You know,
but they produce 100 plus bushel wheat, 150 bushel wheat with a slope that we can't hardly stand on. So, I mean, those guys they're up to speed, you know, and the 100 bushel wheat takes a lot of fertilizer, you know, you got to have the fertilizer there, you know, it's got to be in the soil because the roots need to grab it and use it there. And on those slopes, it'll get away from them if they spread it, you know.
I see. Yeah, it makes sense. And so then you've kind of proven the concept at this point. You know, you're having good test results. You know, people are starting to really pay attention. They're looking at what you've got going on. I guess, when did this become more of a viable commercial product then at this point with your openers?
Oh, in the 90s.
Yeah.
In the 90s, one exciting event that I did have, everybody told me, well, you know, your product is never going to work in the heavy soil. And I said, well, we'll see about that. So I went to Winnipeg in the Canada, and they got some of the heaviest soil there is in the North American, South America, really, south of Winnipeg. And I had this German farmer guy that was a genius farmer. And his name was Roland Fitzner, and he and I got to be the closest friends. And like I was putting, you know, 120 pounds of actual N below canola seed in Winnipeg, and everybody said, I took a research drill up there, and everybody said, well, don't have to worry about that canola coming up, you know. And I don't know how many of you know how tough it is to dig for canola in the soil. I mean, the canola is smaller than some of the soil, you know, but they did put a treatment on the outside to maintain germination and stuff on the seed. And that was a bright blue. So Roland Fistner's wife told me, she said, you're never going to find that canola seed with your digging with your finger. And I said, well, what do you mean? How am I going to find it? She said, I got a table fork. So she said, the only way you're going to find it, you got to click it with a table fork, and the table fork would bring that seed right up, and you just about fall over, you know. And had some of the largest canola yields with that anhydrous ammonia placement and the phosphorus placement, like we were doing it behind that research drill that fall. And boy, we were off to the races in the heavy soil then.
Yeah, you know? Well, no, that's great. Yeah, that was probably a huge
step. Well, that's, if you know that area, it's just terrible. It's like glue and water mixed together. You know, it's just glue and water. Six to everything.
I'm pretty ignorant once you cross the border. I mean, honestly, if you get too north in Nebraska, I'm completely lost. So, yeah, it's nice for a little bit of that.
Well, it's just like the Red River Valley. It's the Red River Valley only into Canada, you know, before the river runs into Lake Winnipeg. Okay. Yeah. Oh, it was fun. And those people were just, and then the farther west you got, the nicer the soil was. It had less of that, that real tough, challenging clay, you know?
Okay. Yeah. So, that's interesting.
Got a lot of friends in Canada.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. Yeah,
Dad, you should talk a little bit about how you transitioned into being a speaker with the no-till stuff and moving into Ukraine and some of your trips in Kazakhstan and then eventually meeting Michael Horsch and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know where you want to begin.
Oh, yeah, well...
yeah, go ahead.
Well, there was a company that I was working with, the Concord Company out of Fargo, North Dakota, and wonderful people. Howard Dahl was the head of that, and he was a very, very forward guy, wanting to try everything new possible. And then he had a friend through, they were Mennonites, and he had a friend from Germany that came over was at a meeting that I went to. Every winter I would develop a whole bunch of new stuff for the company and for myself, and we'd head to where it wasn't frozen. So I went down to Texas and worked in the Texas area in the soil there, and we're developing new stuff, because that would step you ahead in the game a little bit to have that happen. And so I always would go back. And when I got back to Fargo, I would go give a presentation to the board of directors of the Concord Company. And this farmer from Germany, Michael Horsch, was there. And he and I are about the same age. And he listened to what I was doing. And he said, can you come over to Germany and give us what you're doing? And we want to start doing it to see if we can see a big advantage. You know, let me tell you, a little Norwegian boy telling the German farmers, this is how you got a farm. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
If you can imagine anybody been around that scenario, you can imagine. But so we actually the target farmers that we wanted to get this experiment going with, I invite them over to my farm. And we started bringing 90 or 100 farmers from Europe, and especially from East Germany when the wall went down. And these farmers, they needed to, I mean, they were convinced that Moscow wasn't going to come back, take the land. So they said, we got to start farming, because we don't need 4,000 people at the collective farm now. We only need about 50 or less, you know. Okay. So they had to come over and they had to get Western farming technology under their belt. And so we did that for them, and it was real good. They were wonderful people, and you know, because the communists tore all the fences out. So it was West Germany had big fields just like in the States, and you know, then East Germany had the big fields, and West Germany had still had the small fields. But
that's it.
Yeah, so that's what we did. And we got going there, and they're putting the fertilizer down. And I got to be real good friends with this young farmer that was absolutely wonderful. And he was in East Germany, and his farm was owned by Karl Wenzel. It was one of Hitler's top generals, and he was buried there and stuff. And where we would stay in his house, the steps were all wore out from the SS guys going up and down the steps all the time. But I mean, the history was there, and he was very focused. He would say, well, what about this? What about that? Can we do this? Can we do that? And had wonderful soil. And I'm sure he and I are about the same age. And
yeah,
no, that was really exciting.
Oh, I can't imagine. And for those that don't know, because you don't really see that footprint of Horsch necessarily in my part of Nebraska yet. You're starting to see some of those maestro planters now down here. Mm-hmm. But I definitely think there's more of an impact probably through the Dakotas and then maybe across the border. But you're also starting to see a little bit of action, you know, in Indiana and some of those other states. They've got a little bit of a footing, at least currently, with equipment. And so I think that's an interesting subject there with Horsch, because they truly are innovative. And the other thing I really appreciate, similar that, not that we'll ever even hold a candle to those great folks there, but you know, it's a family owned operation. And to my knowledge, there's no outside, you know, shareholders. Yeah. It's just 100% family, and they do billions of dollars in revenue. Yeah. And it's, they've got some amazing designs. Engineering is strong. And I was over in Hanover in Germany, recently for Agritechnica, and you know, man, you should, their display and all their innovation, they continue to innovate, and not only innovate, but then they actually get down to it like you do and really engineered and develop these products. So the feedback then was obviously quite positive. And then you began this relationship with some of their manufacturing then, or is that what the next step was with your openers? Was that more tied into?
Yeah.
Really interesting.
The first thing they did was built a big soil bin like I built.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And you know, and they Germanized it. You know, it was way nicer, and it was really nice. And they built what they called the fit center. That was a fit center where they did all their brought all their customers in. They showed them what was new. They showed them what they were working on. You know, so that they thought there's even going to be something better in the future. And that was really good. And that's where I was with them there. You know, with the future stuff in Germany and they had the big soil bin there that went back and forth, and it was really big and worked really well, and it really opened the eyes of the customer, just saying, well, if the OEM is right down in the hands and knees developing this stuff, it's going to work.
Yeah,
you know, and that's what happened. They did the same thing I did, and we got to be really close friends. And And along with all the farmers too, the farmers knew that we were focused and that the horses were focused, and that's all it took to make the sales, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And then was that just a standard offering then from Horsch with your product, or was it kind of an upgrade, if you will, or how did that tie in with their line of machinery with drills?
Yeah, it was kind of a whole new thing. You know, to have the most drills just had a disc rolling in the work soil, where this knife that went along, placed fertilizer and placed seed above it, and then did everything at once, was a whole different ball game, because none of the seeding equipment had anything for fertilizer on it. They spread all the fertilizer and stuff as they needed it. And they, with wheat, they kind of had to do that too, you know, because the wheat would keep growing and using nitrogen through the season. And they did have to, you know, they spread ammonium nitrate and stuff in dry on and stuff, because they're going for 150, 180 bushel to the acre of wheat.
Oh, wow.
Yield, yeah. Or more, way more than us, you know. Mm. So you're talking a lot of tonnage.
Yeah, you know? Definitely.
Yeah. That's what your climate will do for them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely adds up to a different scale. And, you know, from that relationship. Go ahead. Sorry.
And then, you know, now corn's coming in there, you know, and it's gotten in there, and everybody's doing as much corn as they can. And they needed to have another product to rotate. You know, they weren't rotating much at all. They maybe rotated wheat and barley, you know, winter wheat, and never spring wheat. It was all winter, you know, mainly and stuff. So they needed to have some rotations if they could. And we always did big meetings there too. And we'd invite scientists, you know, from all over, as well. I wanted to just mention about, I got involved with a Ukrainian guy, that was, same age as I am. And when the wall went down, you know, they were all scrambling in Ukraine, saying, you know, what can we do here? We don't know about new agricultural technology. You know, they didn't have any tractors. They didn't have any seeding stuff, because it was all wore out, because all the wealth went to Moscow until it finally fell apart. And so this guy by the name of Vladimir Hrishkov, he came over. He and I were the same age. He came over and through an interpreter. I mean, I didn't even know this guy. He saw my name in some of the no-till farming stuff. And he came and he sat in our kitchen and asked if he could live with us for a week, 10 days to figure out, how to farm like a Western farmer. And and my wife and I looked at each other. Well, we don't even know the guy, but he did have an interpreter that was from New York. And so as long as we didn't have a language barrier, he was in. And he lived with us. And then he said, I'm just here because my people are going to starve to death. And the beautiful land in the Ukraine at that time was growing up the weeds. So anybody that had any way to control the weeds could farm it for nothing if they would just control the weeds and stuff. So it, can you imagine? It was so amazing, you know? And so I told Hrishkov, okay, you know, we're going to do field days. We got to get these your people over. And so they bridged this gap that they probably had a 30-year gap in agriculture, which is pretty huge. You know, and they needed to know how to bridge this gap, and they didn't have any money either, you know. And so we got through all of it, and Hrishkov, he was farming the land, and he had some money. He had his base for making money was he had about 53 farm parts stores where he would they would sell farm equipment parts and stuff like that. He had them all over the Soviet Union and Ukraine and stuff. And so he had some cash flow, you know. Okay. But and so he had all these people just saying, here, have my land. It's growing up the weeds. You got to help me. And so we did that, and we built a factory there and started manufacturing the farm machinery that we were making in the U.S. And our target market was the Kazakhs, the Kazakhs in Kazakhstan, and they were wonderful. They had nicest land I've ever been on. All flat and beautiful land, and when they fertilized and seeded like they did, it just went real good for them, and they were making money because their target market was just hauling the grain over to China, you know. So and they weren't very far from China, you know.
No,
so we know I mean that was another years. Example. Maybe I jumped the gun here, but
it's pretty impressive, and you know, a 30-year gap. And if you even think about that, it might as well have been 100 years. You know, what difference does it really make at this time period? And, you know, even right now, and just my simple row crop corn and beans, you know, potentially a 10-year gap takes away a lot of this more recent planting technology. So I can only imagine you're almost going from, you know, donkeys and horse, you know, drawn to technology probably at that point. So that's pretty impressive that you guys were able to get a foothold over there as well. Yeah, we're getting quite a few questions. It was an eye-opener. Oh, I can imagine. I got a question here I'm going to jump into real quick because, you know, we've got to pick on Scott a little bit. But, you know, the question came through somebody here off my Case IH here on YouTube. But the question is, I wonder what Scott thought about his father's inventions at home and adventures abroad when he was a boy and a young man and helping out with the farm operation. Scott, I guess surely this was quite pivotal in your direction. And I guess, what were your thoughts on growing up in this type of inventive household?
Well, should I plug my ears?
Dad worked a lot. Okay. And I think Corey and I are both really hard workers, and we got that from seeing Dad put in the work. I mean, he was gone before we woke up usually every day, and we'd see him home for dinner. And then after dinner, he'd usually be on the phone with Europe or something like that. And, you know, like the incredible amount of effort that he had to put in order to, you know, be as influential as he did, not purposely, he was just trying to help people. And then he became an influencer in the 90s and, you know, 2000s and so on in agriculture, and that's how we got to go all over the world. But just the main thing that we saw was just the incredible work ethic that Dad had to getting things done. And there's people who are busy, but then there's a group of people that just get things done, and those are the people that at the end of the day become successful because they finish what they started. And you know, that's one thing that we really picked up from Dad is start something and finish it, and don't let anything get in your way.
Yeah. Well, and it's almost cliche, but so many people talk about producers and farmers in particular and, oh, we're feeding the world. Well, you know, really in my neck of the woods, I don't know if there's a lot of truth in that statement, but that's what's so interesting, you know, with what you've been a part of, Kevin. You really did help feed the world. You know, you took these areas that are basically beyond fallow. They're just, you know, never ending weed seeds, basically. And you help them get on solid ground again. And, you know, and all that regime change and everything that went to with all the geopolitical implications, and we're helping the farmers. And I think that's an honorable story too. It's a lot of time invested. And what I hate other people saying about other, oh, he's just a workaholic. And I've always hated when anybody gets labeled being a workaholic, because I've been around workaholics. And I'll tell you what a workaholic is to me, is they're very much inefficient with their time. And they constantly look busy because they're chasing the lack of organization that they fail at. And I think there's a big difference between being a workaholic and then what Scott touched on is being efficient, you know, and then having these goals and then actually capturing the goal and succeeding. And so that's really cool. I guess I honestly didn't know a lot about what you were doing in Ukraine, you know, and some of those areas there. I knew about Horsch Anderson because that's a really cool brand. And then the more I've been able to travel and then been in the ag industry, it was really interesting to me. So along the lines of that, more so official.
One other thing I want to add to that. Mm-hmm. One thing I picked up from Dad is how one guy from the middle of nowhere can create a ripple effect across the globe, really. Mm-hmm. And a funny thing, you know, a lot of farmers. So I have a seed company. We sell seed, and we had tickets to Cancun for four people. So farmer and his wife, two farmers and their wives could go. And we went through our whole seed customer list, and we were able to get one seed customer that was actually interested in going to Cancun for this all expenses paid trip. A lot of guys just didn't want to get on an airplane, didn't want to leave the farm. And the important thing is you really have to get out of your comfort zone, which is your little bubble on your farm, if you want to affect change and if you want to be something successful. I mean, you can be successful inside of your little bubble, but if you're willing to go outside your farm, outside your little bubble, I always say you got to get off the farm if you want to learn and really, really do other things. You know, like I've done a lot of different things in regenerative ag that my neighbors thought I was crazy, but I left the farm to learn those things. Mm. And, you know, some worked, some didn't. But yeah, you just getting off the farm and being unafraid or fearless when it comes to taking on risk that can affect change, you know, like that's like the Steve Jobs of farming, if you will.
Okay. Yeah, that's a fair title, you know, because there's a lot to back that up. And I guess with the whole relationship with Horsch, was Horsch Anderson, was that just kind of a more of an initiative with them, or was that more of a brand of some of the products that were built? I never quite fully understood the whole context, because I know there was a lot of innovation there. Was that basically a separate brand as a collaborative, or how did the organization work?
Well, that was the agreement we had in the U.S. So it would be Horsch and Anderson in the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know, and then the growth was amazing. You know, when you have good products and good customers, you're going to have growth. And it was growing so big that, you know, I decided to back down and let the horses keep going. My sales manager is still with them. You know. Oh, cool. And it is, they're all over. They built a big, huge facility in Brazil. And I think it was Brazil.
Yes.
And they're doing great there. And no, they're very aggressive. And we had a wonderful time together. And no regrets.
And I'm envious, and I've never seen this, and I hope somebody from Horsch listens to this request, but they made a mounted planter series of the Maestro. I believe they called it the RC, and I don't believe it was a true stack. I don't think it was a true vertical fold, but I've never been able to find one of their mounted planters in the wild. And if anybody from Horsch is listening, I'd love to see a video of that planter folding. Are you guys still manufacturing it? If you are or are not, you need to send those manufacturing gigs here in Nebraska where everybody's mounted, because I think it'd be a cool product.
Did you get that, Michael? Can you hear him, Michael?
Yeah, we need to send this to him, or maybe you can. He might actually open your email, but it'd be great to see, because there could be some more innovation. And then, again, back to Nebraska, there's so many guys, and there's a group called Planter Works of Nebraska, about an hour down the highway from me, and they make their own toolbars. they came up with what, you know, the people in our local area were looking for. And that was a mounted planter that, you know, folded differently. They wanted CCS on it. They now with high speed technology. And there's a few groups like that. You know, there's a guy, MC Planters out of Kearney, makes phenomenal precision builds. And it's just, they're just paying attention to what everybody in the area needs. And I think getting that feedback again to Scott's point is, yeah, sometimes you just got to go outside of your farm. And it's surprising how many friends of even my mom and dad have literally never gone on a vacation, you know, and it's just, I don't know. Surely there's a little bit more to just putting seeds in the dirt. And so I'm not trying to pick on anybody locally, but it is. And I was quite ignorant too. I'd never had traveled, you know, a little bit different. My travel was always more work related, but it is quite eye opening to actually meet other people and go to these different markets, if you will. And so I think, but there was obviously a lot of opportunity. And I think that's what you captured, you know, with your visits into Germany and Ukraine as well.
You know, the one thing I'll comment on, it's all about in manufacturing, whether you're a breeder or if you're a welder or whatever, it's all, you know, who's going to get away with the biggest demand, you know, demand of that product. And, look at the planner and singulation and Eugene Keaton and what he did and all those guys. I was so lucky in my life to have one of the first 12 guys to patent a gene, and he and I were real close friends. I did a lot of stuff for him, and he since passed away. But if you can imagine to be right in there with Eugene Keaton and the finger pickup, and then right in there with all the genetics and stuff. And his company was called Warschnuck Genetics, and he was a wonderful guy. Worked hard because I could tell one quick story. Can I?
Yeah, please. We got plenty of time.
Okay. Well, my friend that I'm talking about told me, he said he was always a lot of times working right beside who's the big guy now, that the older guy that was in on Forbes magazine, you know, just lately, Scott.
Was it Beck Seeds, the Beck guy?
Or maybe are you talking about Harry Stein out of Iowa, or
Harry. So, my friend told me, he says, yeah, Harry, he had some plots right by us. And so we're all harvesting these plots. And he says, when we get done with a plot, we stop with the drill and we take empty each container and we weigh it and we tag it and everything. He said, not Harry. He had these special cans. And when he got to the end of the field, the can that ran over is the one he saved. The other two he dumped on the ground and kept going. So he got four times more done than we did in a day, you know. And that's a farm. Yeah, that's a farmer for you, you know. And he's one of the biggest pioneers in the industry. Really, when you think about it, you know, Harry Stein.
Yeah, he really is. And I've never actually had the pleasure of meeting Harry in person. But what I find so interesting about Mr. Stein is when I ever had to call him on some other unrelated business, you know, the receptionist would be like, hey, I'm punching you through to Harry. And the guy picked up the phone call every single time. And what I was dealing with him on some oil and gas stuff, I mean, the guy would just go over every single line and try to save $74. You know, and it's just, and that's the type of business person he was. Every detail matters to Harry. And for me, not knowing him personally or anyone in his family, I know his daughter heads up his legal division, but hey, how about you just talk to Harry? You know, and they'd punch me over and connect me. And just shockingly, that guy talked to me, you know, usually about a check, if you will, like a royalty payment for $2,500. And here where there's an $88 discrepancy, and Harry's fighting me over $88, and I'm thinking, gosh, aren't you the richest person in Iowa? You know, and that's Mr. Stein, for example. But you know, but he's actively doing that's business. The rumor, the rumor is he's good at table tennis or ping pong. So I think we need to add that wrinkle into the show and get some of these guys in ag, and we'll set up a table here at Tractor Tuesday, because I'm quite confident in my abilities there. But no, I think we've got some other questions. Maybe, I'm not sure. There's so many that come through and go, but don't mean to sidetrack us here, but it's been a lot of fun just learning a little bit more about the innovations. You probably have never really retired. You probably, I'm just assuming here, you probably have just turned 70 or you're 69 years old, I'm guessing. So you're,
I turned 70 now. Yeah.
Just, okay.
Yeah. Great. Got a new boost on life.
Yeah.
I have another story like
Harry. Please. Harry. Yeah,
going, yeah. So I was also good friends with the founder of the Ag Chem Company, Al McQuinn, you know, and he was that way. And then Norm Bauer, his head of engineering, came to my farm and he said he was retiring. And he said, you know, Kevin, if you need some help in engineering stuff, I'll be more than happy to drive out from Watertown, Minnesota, where he lived, and I'll help you whenever I can. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness. And then Al McQuinn too. I don't know if he's still living, but you know, he was the founder of the Rogator and the spreaders and all that stuff. And had a wonderful company, very open-minded guy. You know, we were going to try to work on having, you know, doing an air planter behind his machine too, you know, so we never quite got it done, but he was a definite motivator.
Yeah,
he motivated a lot of people, you know, and so did his daughter. You know, they had all that precision soil sampling and everything that they were the people that designed all that. Can I talk about the future a little bit?
Yeah, please, because that's one thing
I think is really important for Dad to mention is his influence in antique farm machinery and restoring. Not only preserving the history with the farm shows that we do, the antique farm shows, but Dad has a collection of antique farm machinery from steam traction engines, steam cars, old John Deere tractors, Case crawlers, international crawlers, like probably has 150,000 square feet of storage with all these antiques, and they all operate Model Ts and all this different stuff he's collected over the years. And I think that's another area that I think has really helped Dad with his whole story is his passion for collecting antiques and just figuring out how stuff works. Like if it's a 110-year-old steam car or a 120-year-old steam traction engine, I mean, he can fix it.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's just, and it's not uncommon, Kevin, to be a professional hoarder once you're a farmer. So I think that's a part of it. I think the difference is my family we had probably 150,000 square feet of a hoard, but it was growing up in trees. And it was on the next generation to clean that up. It's amazing what you can find. But no, we'd love to potentially, you know, look into that. And it's one day Scott's going to invite me up north and I'm going to come take a look if you don't mind. And I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
A guy like Machinery Pete would probably
been doing really love to spotlight
it. Oh, it'd be awesome. Because have you ever heard of Pioneer Village? Well, over here Nebraska, they've got a lot of great pieces there. And Pioneer Village. It's pretty interesting. Yeah. Yeah. But no, that sounds really neat.
We've been doing an antique machinery show.
Yeah, it'd be kind of cool.
We've been doing an antique machinery show for 50 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and it's one quick story. You know, it's fun how ag all ties in, but probably 2015, I was running our planter for the second year in a row, and I had a row unit plug up, and I got to the headland, and I lifted it up, and within that row unit, I caught my dad's first ever waterproof cell phone in one of the disc openers, but then I also caught a horseshoe, actually, for a mule in the same, you know, pass, and basically dug up something from over 100 years ago and then dug up something from that current century. But it's interesting. You still will find the remnants of the past, even in modern farming. But of all of your collection, I guess, what are some of the units that you're most proud of and that you cherish the most?
Well, I love the steam tractors, mainly. And Corey, my other son, he recreated the largest steam tractor that the Case company ever built. Case was the largest, GI Case was the largest manufacturer of steam tractors. They made over 35,000 steam tractors in their day and stuff. Yeah. And so we created, Corey recreated the largest one, and we pull a 50 14 inch plows with it just to show how much power it has.
Wow.
At our antique machinery show every year. Yeah. And we so just celebrated 50 years last year.
When is the big show? I think I've actually heard of this. And again, I wasn't aware this was yours.
Weekend after Labor Day.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. So just kind of
the weekend after Labor Day, same time. Yeah.
Hmm. Okay. Well, another good reason to not go to Husky Harvest Days in Nebraska.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right.
About the same time.
That's been on a long time.
Yeah. I'll leave my opinions to myself on that one, but that's just up the road about 25 minutes. But it'd be fun. Yeah. We need to come check it out. But yeah, we're just south of Grand Island. Yeah. We're in Hastings, Nebraska here. And I haven't checked on Scott's cows yet, but I know they're down here right now too. God, there's so many great questions, but you know, we really could do a whole separate episode just talking about some of the classic and restored units that you have, you know, and just like every farmer, they never really retire. And I guess you're probably still coming up with different ideas and inventions in your head. Have you put any of those to test recently, or have you had any other wrinkles or ideas about new ag innovations recently?
Oh yeah. Before I die, we're going to see, we're going to take the nitrogen out of the air and put it in the soil.
And that's something that,
that's where it comes from now. We just have to use anhydrous.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a group, I think, demonstrating recently at Farm Progress in Decatur, that I was at, and I didn't actually see the demonstration, but I know there was at least some literature going around, you know, talking about the concept of it. And it just, to the average dirt farmer like me, it just seems so abstract, you know, and I don't necessarily have the mind to process all that, but it was a really interesting concept.
Well, to get enough energy to make it happen, to take the nitrogen out of the air and put it and make it a usable nitrogen, NH3, we actually have to, right now, we have to have the energy of a hydrogen fuel cell to do it. You know, but I believe that someday the corn planter is going to go down the field. It's going to be grabbing the nitrogen out of the air and putting it in the soil, because it's going to be as natural as it gets.
Wow!
Right?
Yeah, that's quite the headline right there. Natural
fertilizing.
Huh? Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I said that's quite the headline right there, because I know there's more chatter about this, and it's interesting. You've probably been more so on the front lines of this as it started to develop. So have you done any actual experiments on your end, or have you just contributed to this space?
It's all talk right now.
Okay. Yeah, well, no, I understand. Yeah, there's,
you know,
probably can't say too much.
I mean, we know the parameters. Everybody knows the parameters. I mean, anybody that makes anhydrous ammonia knows what they're doing, you know.
Okay.
And Koch brothers might not like it, but.
Well, you know, sometimes you got to disrupt. And I think that's a big part of what we try to do at Tractor Tuesday. And there's a lot of people that don't like what we're doing here. And so that's great. You know, we need a few more that don't. And I think
I'm not the only one.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I just I even told my dad, I go, I need to look at getting an armored car. we're getting to a different point of disruption where, you know, people really aren't happy with this. And it's unfortunate. Probably two of these groups are right here in Nebraska with me. So, you know, at least some of your, I won't get too deep into it, but some of your enemies, if you will, they're probably not in the Dakotas, at least. I think that's a good thing. You might have a couple states in between, at least. But no.
Well, my enemies must be poor shots.
Yeah,
well. See, my enemies must be poor shots because I'm still around.
Yeah, exactly. No, and there's a lot more cool development to come. So are you still hands-on a little bit with the boys and the farm operation, or do you just kind of watch from the sidelines now?
Pretty much just I watch from the sideline stay out of the way.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
Old guys can get in the way.
Well, and see down right here.
Do you guys say that?
Do you mow ditches up there like everybody else's dad and grandpa does? Or, you know, that's the big thing. That's how you really retire in Nebraska and Iowa, is you mow ditches. I wasn't sure that's how you do it.
We let the cows do that.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. Good. Yeah.
Dad likes to work on stuff that's 100 years old or older.
Okay. Yeah. So you're probably not interested Yeah, not interested in our John Deere. It's not old enough yet.
Yeah, you know, if you come to my place, we'll steam up the steam car and we'll go 70 mile an hour in that steam car.
Wow, that's unreal.
1910.
Jeez.
Yeah. That's we can go amazing. 100 if you want. We'll just go 70.
I'm okay with we go 45. That's good enough for me. I don't have this need for speed like Scott does, but as long as it works and it's halfway comfortable, I'll go for a spin. But you got to
no seat belts.
Oh, that's okay. Well, then we'll go 30. Yeah, even better. So we'll just barely test it. Then I as being the oldest first time dad in Nebraska, I got to stay alive as long as I can. And I don't want them to say, "Well, how did Zach die?" Well, he's in a steam car up in South Dakota. You know, I want to avoid any issues there. And I don't know if my life insurance would cover me on that one. So we'll run it by the insurance guy first.
You can't tell him.
Okay.
Yeah, don't tell him.
Yeah, you know, maybe we'll just scrub that from the live stream then. But hey, Kevin, we should probably start to wrap things up. I know we covered so many awesome points today. We're going to have to invite you back after we get a few other guests in between. And maybe we could really boil down something more in particular. But we just, you know, as a fan of what you've done in the industry, we just wanted to get you a part of all this. And then just the way everything works in the universe, it's just, to me, I find it hysterical. You know, obviously knew a little bit about the lore and the history. And then as I got to know Scott, I never really put two and two together until recently, you know, that this is you. And so it's an honor to have you on. I guess if you had any last final words for the few folks listening, you know, it can be a little bit of anything like, hey, you know, get our openers, something inspirational. Anything that you may have to say to the audience that will watch this?
Well, agriculture is the most exciting industry in the world. Mm-hmm. There isn't anything that's more exciting and more important, you know, than food and safe food and good food. And we only hit the tip of the iceberg. You know, we don't have an oxen pulling the air seater though. You know, we're doing it with more mechanized stuff, but there's just all kinds of stuff that's going to happen, in just look in our short lifetimes what we've seen,
right?
You know, how many acres of corn do you do in a day now?
Yeah, it just depends on who I'm talking to. Yeah, but it really is, and the production's there, and we continue to optimize and become more efficient. So no, that's a great way to put it, Scott. Any last?
Yeah, and we're as close to zero pollution in the whole planting system and the growing system of the corn that we've ever been in the history of the production of corn, production of any crops actually. Mm. Yeah, we took the tillage out so we don't wreck the soil. We just fertilize it and seed it.
Yeah, that's great. Hey, Scott, any last words on your end?
No, I'm just grateful for my dad for the opportunities that he's given me and the passion that he obviously has for agriculture, both old and new agriculture. And I'm just grateful to carry part of the torch from what he started.
Yeah, it's great. And then we're right on time here with the locals here on the train tracks. So I guess we'll wrap it up with the horns honking. But again, thanks again, Kevin. We appreciate your time, all the information. It was an honor to have you on, and I think our audience will really appreciate some of these great points that you brought up today, and we'll have some really excellent clips from this show. I think you provided some great quotes for us. So with all that, folks, I appreciate everyone for tuning in. If you have time out there in the audience, click like. Feel free to subscribe to our channel. Get notifications because, today is Tuesday, but we came on a little bit live a little bit earlier. Sign up for the notifications. You never know when we're going to go live, and thank you for all the great questions. For Scott Anderson and our new friend here to the audience, Kevin Anderson, again, it's been an honor. I'm Zach Bosley, Tractor Tuesday Live, signing off. Till the soil